In the polarized debate over the health reform law, some commentators on the right have been expounding this theory that President Obama is actually laying the groundwork for a government single-payer health system by trying to overwhelm the states with new Medicaid expenses they can't afford. The states would then appeal to Washington in this scenario to relieve them of the unsustainable burden, and gradually, voila, federal single-payer. The theory itself requires a few leaps of faith, but also interesting is the historical context. They call it the Cloward-Piven strategy, a reference to an article in The Nation magazine in the 1960s by sociologists Richard Cloward and Francis Fox Piven. Their proposal at the time was not about health reform, but a way to end poverty. They wanted all Americans eligible for welfare to sign up to overwhelm state budgets and place pressure on Washington to enact a guaranteed annual income for all Americans. Republican President Richard Nixon was actually interested in the idea for a while, but it never got passed. Back to the present, the Cloward-Piven strategy is now being invoked so much in the conservative press and so inaccurately, according to Frances Fox Piven, that she is speaking out to correct, from her point of view, what she was actually about in the 1960s. So joining us now are Francis Fox Piven, sociology and political science professor at the CUNY Graduate Center, and Barbara Ehrenreich, author of Nickel and Dimed and many other books, who has an article about this whole brouhaha in The Nation magazine right now. Welcome back, both of you, to WNYC. Hello.
Glad to talk to you, Brian.
Barbara, yeah. You there?
Yes, I'm glad to be with you.
Good. So, Dr. Piven, take us back to 1966. Did you propose trying to overwhelm state budgets with welfare recipients as a means to a guaranteed annual income at the federal level?
Well, yeah, that was the basic outline of the strategy, but you need a little bit of background to understand the urgency of the issue. In the 1960s, lots of people, many of them African-Americans, Puerto Ricans, were being displaced from agriculture because mechanization meant that their labor was no longer needed. Those people were very, very poor, and they languished for a while in southern cities but gradually made their way to northern cities. Now, in the North, when those people got to the North, and we have data on this, they did not apply for welfare. Most of them were looking for work. And only after quite a while did people in desperation turn to welfare. But then, you have to know something about the inner workings of the welfare system at that time. What welfare staff typically did in New York was to give people bus tickets back to South Carolina or Alabama instead of processing their applications for welfare. The result was that both in the South and in the North, despite great, great need and desperate poverty of children, women, men, the welfare rolls did not rise. Now, this was, in fact, illegal. What was going on in welfare departments all over the country was denying people benefits that they were legally entitled to. The 1966 article, which was published in a small magazine in The Nation, was much smaller then than it is now, was a call for advocates, activists, the many groups that were springing up in the cities in response to the dire economic situation of poor people, minority people. We called on them to help people get welfare because they helped the people that were legally entitled to get welfare. But we then spelled out how these claims would make themselves felt fiscally and politically in the cities and in the states. And we said it would be a lot of trouble for the cities and the states. Cities and states were fiscally strapped. The groups that would be making these claims were unpopular. They were in conflict with many better established groups in the city. On the other hand, the federal government was then a Democratic government. Lyndon Baines Johnson was president. And we didn't think that a Democratic president whose electoral base was increasingly in the big cities could afford to let the cities and let the states endure these fiscal and political consequences. We thought that would become pressure for a more reasonable system for providing income, cash assistance, to those who needed it most. And that was the article. It was not an article about bringing down capitalism, about causing a financial crisis. It was an article about making welfare more legal, but taking into account that making the welfare system operate according to the law and regulations would also create fiscal and political problems, and then arguing that maybe those fiscal and political problems would generate pressure for a better system.
So you think that when talk show hosts or whoever invoke the Cloward-Piven strategy these days, because it seems to be making you more angry than proud, they get the strategy right, but they get the goals wrong?
They get the strategy a little bit wrong, too. It wasn't a strategy for creating a crisis in capitalism. I'm not so bold or so brilliant as to have been able to think of that. They get the strategy wrong, and they also get the goals wrong. It was a strategy for reform. Now, reform in the United States, you know, our episodic periods of reform that have, over the course of two centuries, made the United States a more humane country, those periods of reform have always been the result of upsurges from below and the problems that such upsurges create for institutions in the society. So in that sense, you know, it was a reckoning back to American history, to the struggles of that preceded the Revolutionary War, to the struggles of the abolitionists, to the labor movement. It was not a revolutionary strategy.
Barbara Ehrenreich and Frances Fox Piven, my guests on WNYC. We can take your phone calls if you've ever heard of the Cloward-Piven strategy until now or not. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Barbara, your telling of history in your Nation article says at the time, a guaranteed annual income was not a wild-eyed radical goal. What was the political context of the time as you look back, and why would Richard Nixon, of all people, have been interested in this idea?
Well, I think it was recognized increasingly that you're going to have to do something about the ravages of unemployment, you know, episodic outbreaks of unemployment and everything. You're going to really have to, at some point, make it possible for people to live in between periods of employment. And that, hence the, you know, seemed like a very technocratically rational thing to many people. Let's have a guaranteed annual income, which you're going to get, won't be that great, but you're going to get, you're going to be able to live despite the ups and downs of the labor market. I just want to throw in a footnote here, Brian, which is, maybe a headline, is how crazy this is. I mean, what we have coming, what's been coming from the Fox News commentators and many in the Tea Party movement, is the idea that Frances Fox Piven, who we're talking to right now, actually brought down the world financial system. I mean, you have the extent of the things that she has been blamed or credited with are amazing. That she did this somehow with the help of Acorn. And don't ask me to explain this, Woodrow Wilson. I mean, we're talking very rationally here.
If I understand that connection correctly from their point of view, just so people know what you're talking about, I think it goes something like with the help of Acorn, that Dr. Piven was somehow behind the push to get subprime mortgages enshrined in Freddie Mae and Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, as a program to help the poor, and because the subprime mortgages help bring down the financial system, that's the connection. Do you think I have it more or less right?
I guess so. Yeah, but I'm just saying, I think we have to just stand back for one moment and realize this is incredibly absurd.
Well, it is a lunatic argument, but in a way, because, I mean, these connections are just fantasies drawn on Glenn Beck's blackboard. But there's a sense in which the story is compelling for, not for most people, but it's compelling for a substantial minority of Americans, the Americans who are searching for some solution and maybe the ones who flock to the Tea Party movement. It's compelling because it's a narrative that makes terrible things that have been happening in their lives absolutely clear. It may be a ridiculous narrative, but it's pretty clear, and it also points to actual people, palpable human beings who caused it all. Now, ridiculous though it may be, it is somehow, I think, comforting for people to have an explanation of what they can't really understand, because it's complicated. It's hard to understand why all the good jobs left our town, why the infrastructure is crumbling. Hard to understand why the ways we always did things, you know, men married women and women married men, and we didn't have all these peculiar sexual things, that all that is kind of being challenged. And so it's both the economic and cultural changes that make people very distressed, some people.
I do want to give you two examples of how it's not just the conspiratorial right that's critical of where you were back then or how this might relate to health reform today. On the liberal website, Talking Points Memo, just today, Jim Sleeper somewhat defends you and somewhat criticizes you. And on the critical side, he says, Cloward and Piven's call for a racialized politics of turmoil held no real solutions. It certainly offered no deliverance to a socialist agenda by relying on a politics of racial theater and paroxysm. And he puts politics of turmoil in quotes, as I guess your own words from the time. Were you about fomenting racialized turmoil, as he calls it?
Richard Cloward and I did publish a book of essays called The Politics of Turmoil. So to that extent, there's something accurate about Jim Sleeper's story. But what's totally inaccurate, and a lot of people who are wobbling between the sort of liberal left and the conservative right, and Jim Sleeper is one of them, he keeps moving back and forth, have a tendency to blame the upheavals of the 1960s, which were driven by the civil rights movement and then by the movement for economic rights by blacks in the North, to blame this on a few left-wing intellectuals. You know, that's ridiculous. That's not how movements occur. Movements are the expression of tremendous upheavals in the lives of people, and also the expression of the hopes that they sometimes have for solutions to their problems. Now, to say that African-American demands in the first place for political rights in the South or for economic rights in the North were a consequence of our little article, or even several little articles, is just unreal. But for these people who are intellectuals and are sometimes sort of wobbly liberals, for these people, that also is a comforting story, because they don't have to look at the massive changes that are going on in our society, changes which are very bad for large numbers of people.
So here's one from maybe a wobbly conservative. In the New Republic, linguist John McWhorter, who is a black conservative but an Obama voter, he wrote last month, rarely in American history have people with such a destructive agenda as Piven and Cloward had such power over the lives of the innocent, helping to ruin the lives of, for example, some of my relatives. He says, traditional civil rights leaders didn't agree with your agenda. Quoting you, he says, Piven has recalled, quote, we met with Whitney Young, executive director of the National Urban League, and he gave us a long speech about how it was more important to get one black woman into a job as an airline stewardess than it was to get 50 poor black families onto welfare, unquote. But he says when Piven and Cloward published a manifesto in The Nation, there were 30,000 reprint requests. 1,000 neighborhood service centers nationwide encouraged people to go on welfare who would not have otherwise. In the 60s, one-third of the people whose incomes made them eligible for AFDC were on the rolls. By 1971, 90% were. So what do you say to John McWhorter and that quote by you about your disagreement with Whitney Young?
Well, I mean, there are a couple of themes that he taps. One is that it wasn't poor people who demanded welfare, or they wouldn't have done it on their own. They only did it because we told them to. And, you know, that wasn't true. When we wrote that article, there were welfare rights groups forming all over the country. And it was knowing about those groups and having some interaction with those poor people that helped inspire the article. The article didn't cause the groups. The groups were there. They were growing. And the article may have been given them some sort of inspiration, but it didn't cause the welfare rights movement. The other thing that's so wrong about that is that getting one black woman a job as an airline stewardess would have still left those other 50 women desperately poor, trying to raise their children, and constantly humiliated both by their poverty and by the receipt of welfare. It is true that welfare was not a good system, but it was not a good system because in exchange for the little bit of cash assistance it gave to families, it in a way extracted their humiliation. They had to be investigated. They had to ask intrusive questions when they went into the welfare department. Inspectors came round to their homes, looked under the bed to see if there was a guy there. But we didn't have to have a welfare system like that. And gradually, as a result of the protests of the poor women who were in the welfare rights groups, gradually those intrusive and humiliating procedures were improved. They weren't improved enough, but they were improved. And people did develop as a result of new regulations issued by HEW, which was what HHS was called at the time, or new Supreme Court rulings. Gradually, people did acquire some rights on welfare. Look, a lot of people get subsidies from the government in this society, not least the bankers. And, of course, farmers have always gotten subsidies from the government. But these people are not humiliated in exchange for the assistance that they get. That's what happened to welfare recipients, and that's what should have been changed.
And Barbara Ehrenreich, your Nation article runs briefly through some of the statistics about poverty itself, like the number of Americans living in statistical extreme poverty, which is about $9,000 or less in today's dollars. And that number went from 12 million Americans in 2000 to 15 million Americans in 2007 to 17 million Americans in 2008, just at the beginning of the recession. Those Americans are almost completely invisible in the media as we focus so much on maybe struggling homeowners, maybe declining 401ks. Do you think poverty is the forgotten issue in American politics today?
Well, I've been saying for a long time now that the real brunt of this recession has been taken by the people who were already struggling before it. Blue-collar people, people of color, disproportionately. It was hard before. It's much, much harder now with so few jobs available. And what drove me and Peter Edelman to write the piece that we wrote in the most recent Nation is just the bitter irony that while the right is attacking Francis Piven for supposedly doing all this to blow up the American, you know, greatly increase the American welfare system and so on, and that's push us somehow into bankruptcy, what is being neglected is the almost total destruction of welfare that has taken place in the last 15 years or so, you know, since welfare reform.
And that isn't because of welfare recipients' demands. In fact, it became easier because those demands subsided. It's rather because of the rise of the right and a larger program to reduce the incomes of working people and poor people. If you slash welfare, if unemployment assistance doesn't keep pace with the cost of living, and if you break unions, a lot of people are going to suffer.
More in a minute with Frances Fox Piven and Barbara Ehrenreich, including what they think of the comparison, which is really what started all this in the general media, between the Cloward-Piven strategy on welfare once upon a time and the new health reform law, this idea that it's a backdoor Obama strategy to overwhelm the states and therefore bring about a single-payer system. More on that and your calls, 212-433-WNYC or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show for Barbara Ehrenreich and Frances Fox Piven. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. My guests right now are Frances Fox Piven, sociology and political science professor at the CUNY Graduate Center. Her name has been widely invoked in the conservative press recently for some of the things she did and advocated in the 1960s, as we've been discussing, to put pressure on the welfare system to try to move toward a guaranteed annual income in America, and a comparison between the new health reform law, which these commentators say is the Obama strategy for pressuring the states into asking the government for a single-payer federal system, and Barbara Ehrenreich, author of Nickel and Dimed and many other books, who has an article about this whole brouhaha in The Nation magazine right now. And our phone number, 212-433-WNYC. 433-9692. Our comments page at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. So Barbara, this analogy with Obama health reform, that it's a stepping stone to national single payer because new Medicaid requirements will overwhelm the states and they'll ask the feds to take more and more of it over. What do you think about that?
Well, I guess Frances could really straighten that out because, and according to these theories, she pretty much tells Obama what to do. But I would be, I'd have to say, I would be very pleased if that was what Obama was thinking. However, you know, we know the Obama administration didn't even stick to the rather feeble public option notion, you know, which would have expanded the public response, direct public responsibility for health insurance. That Rahm Emanuel, you know, that was what he called some liberals very nasty things for wanting to continue to push that. So far, we have seen no zeal for single-payer health insurance whatsoever, unfortunately, from the White House.
Frances, go ahead.
Well, I think that the brouhaha on the right over health care reform is driven by first partisan politics. I think the Republicans have and their right-wing allies like Dick Armey.
But specifically in terms of the Cloward-Piven strategy analogy. Do you think there's anything there?
Well, I don't think there's much of an analogy there. There's the right-wing blogs that I've seen have, for example, made an analogy between what we proposed as a strategy for welfare reform and a later strategy in the 1980s that we proposed for mobilizing people who were not in the American electorate but were entitled to vote, were citizens. We proposed a massive voter registration drive.
The motor voter. People don't know you're behind that largely,
yeah,
right?
That was it was our original idea to make voter registration widely available in all sorts of government and voluntary agencies so that low political participation in the United States, particularly among poorer people, would be overcome. And that strategy had a kind of success with the passage of the National Voter Registration Act 10 years later. Well, the right wing sees these two strategies as the same. Well, in what sense, in what democratic sense, can we think that allowing all people who are entitled to vote is overloading the system? That's the way the system is supposed to work, and it's the way it does not work in the United States today. The health care arguments have, it seems to me, have been a little crazier. People screaming at Tea Party events, "Don't let government get their hands on my Medicare." I mean, that's the result of ignorance fostered by irresponsible propaganda. Medicare is a government program.
Let's go to some calls. Max in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Max.
Good morning, Brian. I always like the guests you have on your show. This is Ms. Piven and her friend. Is an example of the old radical liberals from the 60s, which are more nowadays obsolete and replaced by a globalist ruling class. All those beautiful things that you mentioned about health care and all that, and the movement of the Tea Party, which is trying to regain the ground for middle America, which is seeing more and more running on the treadmill to keep up with so much debt, so much poverty, and so much waste by government, corporate welfare, as you mentioned, and all that, and bailouts, and all that.
So you like hearing what sounds like retro politics?
I like hearing about it, but it's obsolete. It's out of place, and people like her today, liberals like her, are replaced by globalists who have made the country poorer. The middle class here have no value-added work left. It's all disappearing. Silicon Valley is disappearing. You mentioned yesterday about blacks being unemployed and the consequences that illegal immigration has on middle-class unemployment that most liberals today would rather hide under the table and not talk about. But I like to hear about this old classic liberalism because it's out of place in the global America.
Max, thank you for your call.
Maybe not, though. Maybe not. You know, history changes very fast and very unexpectedly. People have not yet had a chance to react to the new hardships associated with the Great Recession. It took a long time in the 1930s before people began to protest unemployment, low wages, the lack of welfare.
George in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, George.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Okay.
Thanks very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I enjoy your program a lot.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm wondering why New York has to be the receptacle for poverty South. I mean, I understand that the South is extremely poor, but I also know that probably up till now, South has had much more of the manufacturing than we have here, particularly mill productions. And, you know, many of the jobs that were shipped out of the South. The South had, you know, didn't have all the high income or high hourly rates that we complained about. But all these jobs have been shipped to India. They've been shipped to...
Right, and that's in recent years. But are you referring to what Dr. Piven said earlier about the black migration from the South in, like, the 1940s and earlier and later? But thereabouts, black migration from the South to the northern cities and how that put a lot of pressure on the welfare system around here?
A tremendous amount of pressure.
So, Dr. Piven, what his question really, as he asked it at the beginning of the call, is why... does New York need to become the depository of Southern poverty?
Well, New York City and other New York City was once a manufacturing town, and not so long ago, until the 1960s, 70s. And a lot of people it was also a union town. A lot of people had decent jobs in New York. It was... the ability of investors, manufacturing investors, to go to the South and get pay lower wages. This anticipated the movement of manufacturers to Bangladesh and to Mexico and to India. First, they moved to the South, where the garment trade, the textile trade, the shoe manufacturing, all moved to the South because wages were low there, and wages were low there in part because of the racial system in the South, which had always placed great pressure on the wages both of whites and of blacks.
Here's a question from our – and, George, thank you for your call. Barbara Ehrenreich, from our comments page, someone writes, when they attack the Cloward-Piven strategy, the idea that an organized and outraged public can and ought to demand change – they are really attacking our most basic democratic tradition. Piven is a target precisely because her work has always supported democratic politics from below. That's exactly what Glenn Beck wants America not to do, and it helps explain why the right is working overtime to offer a counter-narrative, writes this listener. But what do you say to the Tea Party movement, which, you know, though some of it is astroturf, seems to have a lot of kind of working middle class white America as its central participants?
Well, we have an interesting conjuncture of things in the United States. In the last year or two, we've had the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression, and we've had our first black president. And I think there's a very simple way to put those together that the far right has been trying to do, that there's something, some terrible conspiracy here that has racial elements and so on, and somehow manages to mix up Nazism and socialism and so on. But I think that I wanted to say that this person who wrote in is absolutely right. I mean, Frances Fox Piven and Richard Cloward, who is unfortunately died a few years ago, really represent an era, you know, of mass movements from below, from the working people, from the poor, and so on. And that's, I think, you know, what is so difficult for Glenn Beck, et cetera, to understand, that we had such movements were not manipulated by the rich, by corporate capitalism or something, and that, you know, that did threaten the status quo. I think they hate that idea. They think they're the big movement for social change. And with Frances Fox Piven, you have the real thing.
Right. They see the status quo as high taxes and the wealthy manipulators being people like George Soros.
And Frances Fox Piven,
I guess.
Who's not wealthy, but who's just a manipulator. They're trying to, as she said very patiently, and I thought very forgivingly, that they want an explanation for the world. And there's nothing like a conspiracy to explain everything, even when it's completely wrong.
And that's going to be the last word on the Cloward-Piven strategy as being discussed in the media today, the version delivered by Frances Fox Piven herself, who is sociology and political science professor at the CUNY Graduate Center, and Barbara Ehrenreich, author of Nickel and Dimed and many other books, who has an article about this whole brouhaha in The Nation magazine right now. Thank you both so much for coming on.
Thank you, Brian, and thank you, Barbara.
Oh, my pleasure.
Bye.
Bye.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in just a minute, we will talk to Laura Munson. Perhaps you know her New York Times Modern Love column that was so commented on they had to turn off the comments page, on how she saved her marriage after her husband said he didn't really love her anymore and never really loved her. And she said, oh, come on, and she let him take some time off, and well, now it's a book. So we'll talk to Laura Munson in a minute.